In 2014, Fortune magazine ran a cover story featuring Elizabeth Holmes, a blonde woman wearing a black turtleneck staring deadpan at the camera with the headline, "This CEO's out for blood."
Elizabeth Holmes dropped out of Stanford at 19 to start a biotech company. Today, that company, Theranos, is worth billions and still under the radar.
Holmes was the founder of Theranos, a company that promised to revolutionize the blood testing industry. Rather than a deep vein draw, it would do all its tests with a single drop of blood. It promised easier, cheaper, more accessible lab tests with far better healthcare outcomes.
There's an opportunity to create a new paradigm, being able to make actionable health information accessible to people everywhere at the time it matters most.
Holmes was persuasive and aimed her sales pitch at rich, influential people who could give her money and also the veneer of legitimacy. But as it turned out, there was no revolutionary way to test blood. This spring, she settled a lawsuit with the Securities and Exchange Commission, though admitting no wrongdoing, and on Friday, probably the final nail went into the Theranos coffin.
Holmes was once touted as Silicon Valley's sweetheart, but today she and a former company president had to face some serious charges.
The U.S. Attorney's Office accusing her of engaging in a multi-million dollar scheme to defraud investors, doctors and patients.
Holmes and Ramesh Balwani both pleaded not guilty to two counts of conspiracy to commit wire fraud. If convicted, the two can each spend up to 20 years behind bars.
The alleged crimes were uncovered by the dogged reporting of John Carreyrou, an investigative journalist at the Wall Street Journal and author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. John, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So the book is really fast-paced. It was just such a breezy read. Congratulations on that. It's just appalling how this woman, Elizabeth Holmes, was able to bamboozle so many grand old men, from Henry Kissinger to Rupert Murdoch to Jim Mattis and especially George Shultz, William Perry. Do you think the fact that they were all old men past their prime had something to do with it?
I think it was definitely a factor. You know, this is probably controversial to say, but she wrapped all of them around her finger. The first one was Channing Robertson, her engineering school professor, when she dropped out of Stanford, and he helped give her credibility when she was just a teenager. A year or two later, she met Donald L. Lucas, a pretty well-known venture capitalist who had groomed Larry Ellison,
who went on to create
Oracle. And then she met George Shultz, the former Secretary of State, who crafted the Reagan administration's foreign policy, and she wowed him. He joined her board and pretty soon introduced her to all his buddies at the Hoover Institution, which is the conservative think tank housed on the Stanford campus.
So what was the goal of the company? What was the problem it was trying to solve?
Well, in Elizabeth Holmes's view, the blood testing industry was broken, controlled by these two big companies, LabCorp and Quest, and they still use decade-old methods, namely the big hypodermic needle drawing five tubes of blood. She likened it to a medieval torture mechanism. The fact of the matter is that if Elizabeth had invented, as she claimed, a new way to test blood from just a drop or two pricked from a finger from which you could do the full range of tests, that would actually have been a big advance in medicine, something that thousands of researchers and academia and industry have been working on for 20 years, where you would prick the finger, get a small sample of blood, put it in this cartridge, which would slot into a reader, send a signal from the reader to a doctor's computer and give the doctor the patient's blood test result.
Okay, now we have that for testing blood sugar.
It was inspired from the blood sugar glucose monitors, except she wanted them to do all the tests. That's much more difficult to pull off than it might sound because there are different classes of tests, and those different classes of tests require completely different lab methods and completely different lab instruments.
So most 19-year-olds can't secure millions of dollars in funding. So what was so different about Elizabeth?
She at first leveraged her family connections. Her family's neighbors happened to be the Drapers, and Tim Draper is a very well-known and very successful venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. When Elizabeth dropped out of Stanford a decade later, she knocked on Tim Draper's door, and he actually wrote her her first check for $1 million. She also approached a friend of her father's, a guy named Victor Palmieri, who is a retired businessman, and he also invested in Theranos. And she hit up some students in her class at Stanford, the Chang family, and they were heirs to a multi-billion dollar Taiwanese tech distributor.
Yeah, she had connections, but that doesn't mean you can leverage them. Describe this young woman.
Full of energy, believed 100% in her vision, her calling to be an entrepreneur. She got turned down by quite a few venture capitalists. I have an anecdote in my book about a medical technology VC firm investing in med tech companies for decades. And when she sat down with the partners there, she spoke in grand terms of her ability to sort of change mankind. But when they tried to ask her very technical questions, she was stumped and got defensive, and after about an hour, stood up and left in a huff.
And you note that the Theranos story wasn't coming primarily from reporters with healthcare backgrounds, beginning with the Wall Street Journal.
Right. The first mainstream publication that put her on the map was my own newspaper. An op-ed writer named Joe Rago went out to California to interview her in a friendly piece, pretty much took her claims of having invented this groundbreaking new science at face value. And that's the first piece that put her on the map. But then there was a piece in Wired magazine a few months later in early 2014. And then the story that really, really rocketed her to fame was the magazine cover story in Fortune magazine in June of 2014.
Fundamentally, she was a terrific liar, really persuasive. But there were other things that enabled her success for so long. I mean, the story was seductive. Nobody wanted to penetrate the myth.
Right. There was a yearning in Silicon Valley and even beyond Silicon Valley to see the first tech billionaire female founder.
And there's a narrative of the Silicon Valley wunderkind success.
Silicon Valley has a history of faking it until you make it. There was a term that was coined in the early 80s called vaporware that referred to computer software or hardware that was announced by a company with great fanfare and then either never deployed or deployed years later without many of the features that had been promised. If they have bugs, you can fix the bugs and, as people say in Silicon Valley, iterate and put out new versions of the software. And that works okay in the traditional Silicon Valley world of software. You absolutely could not do this in medicine.
Because you could miss something that may ultimately kill you, that's present in the blood test, or you might up your medication or undergo a test that would cost thousands of dollars and potentially harm you.
You can even cause deaths. To give you an example of one of the tests that Theranos got wrong and had to void and correct after my investigative reporting was published, it's a test called prothrombin time, and it's a test that basically measures blood coagulation. Mm-hmm. Doctors rely on that test to determine the dosage of their blood-thinning medication. And if you give them a false result and they adjust the dosage in a way that isn't correct, then the patient can either fall prey to a stroke or bleed out. That one test illustrates how dangerous things can quickly get if you get blood test results wrong.
Though she was operating in the medical field, she was covered like a tech entrepreneur.
Right. Her product wasn't a traditional Silicon Valley product. It wasn't software or computer hardware or smartphone app. It was actually a medical product. But she managed to get the press to approach her from that traditional Silicon Valley perspective. And she modeled herself after Steve Jobs. She wore the black turtleneck. She started doing that as early as 2006, 2007. She hired the same advertising agency that had created iconic Apple advertising campaigns, Chiat Day in Los Angeles. There were also ads in which Elizabeth herself was featured. I'm thinking of one in particular that was directed by Errol Morris, the Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker. Mm-hmm. It's a close-up shot of her, and she's speaking into the camera with her big blue eyes that don't blink much, and she's speaking very slowly and deliberately.
To me, nothing matters more than what people go through when someone they love is found out to be really, really sick. And most of the time when that happens, it happens so late in the disease progression process that there's nothing you can do. And that feeling of helplessness is heartbreaking. And if I could build something that would change it, that was what I want to do with my life.
It's almost hypnotic when you watch her. It calls to mind almost a cult leader when you watch that video.
Holmes's second in command, Sunny Balwani, who is 20 years older than her. Together, they ran this company. It was, as all of the former employees you spoke to describe, it was a fear-driven management style, a paranoid approach to intellectual property, incredibly secretive, and in its public face, you know, it was secrets and lies.
From late 2003 to late 2009, she was with Sunny. They were boyfriend and girlfriend, and they even lived together, but he was not working at the company. He sort of was her consigliere who gave her advice in the background. But she ran the company in those early years in a very secretive manner, and she compartmentalized information and implemented these silos within the company. And then
interesting because the silos weren't just, say, between tech and sales and so on. These were physical silos with blacked out windows, and you couldn't get from one department to another without passing through doors with locks.
That was later when Sunny joined the company. He joined in late 2009 because at that point, Theranos had almost run out of the nearly $50 million it had raised in its first three funding rounds. And it was teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, and Sunny agreed to come in and personally guarantee a credit line that the company took out to stay afloat.
Sunny was a millionaire. He had gotten his money in one big windfall.
Right. I would call it even a stroke of luck. He had joined this little dot-com company with a couple of customers testing its softwares in mid-2009 at the height of the dot-com bubble. And then a few months later, this little startup was acquired by another bigger startup for $252 million. And Sunny, at that point, had been the number two executive of the little startup for a couple months, and he pocketed more than $40 million. So that's how a decade later in 2009, he was wealthy enough to guarantee that bank loan that Theranos took out. And as part of him guaranteeing the bank loan, he came on board and became the president and chief operating officer. And I interviewed dozens of former employees, and they say that the culture of Theranos, which already was secretive and paranoid, got a lot worse from that point forward with Sunny as the number two guy running much of the company day to day. Sunny was someone who was incredibly arrogant and also had a temper. And he took to firing people so often that a new expression was used to describe the firings. When someone wasn't there anymore, they would say Sunny had disappeared him or her.
That's pretty dark. How did Holmes and Sunny Balwani misdirect potential business partners and the press?
The key to the fraud is that Theranos was able to mislead Walgreens. The two companies signed a preliminary partnership agreement by August of 2010, and Walgreens actually hired a laboratory expert as a consultant to help it vet the Theranos technology. After a couple months, Elizabeth and Sunny told Walgreens that they didn't like this consultant named Kevin Hunter, who was interfering with getting work done.
They didn't allow him to have test results. They didn't provide him with any data. Walgreens was so engaged in magical thinking that they permitted their own watchdog to be muzzled and chained.
Really, what was driving this on the part of Walgreens was the fear of missing out. They were afraid that Theranos would walk away and go do a deal with their arch rival, CVS.
Elizabeth Holmes made things up. When she was talking to investors, she had income projections 10 times as big as those she presented internally, and they falsified even their test results when they were forced to provide them.
Right. And one thing that is really important in the deception is that she used the fact that she rolled out the finger stick tests in Walgreens stores as the validation that Theranos' product was real. How could it not be? It was available to consumers in Walgreens stores in Palo Alto and in the Phoenix area. The fact that Walgreens had completely failed to vet the technology or do its due diligence and let Theranos roll out the blood tests then led a bunch of investors to invest money thinking that surely this company that's been around for 100 years has done its homework, when in fact it had not done its homework.
She also claimed that the military was using the technology, and it just wasn't.
Right. She did try to get a field test of the Theranos device in Afghanistan after she met Jim Mattis, who is now our Secretary of Defense, who at the time was the head of CENTCOM. The field test never took place, but she continued to tell prospective investors and board members, people like George Shultz, that the Theranos device was being used in the field in Afghanistan and was in medevac helicopters and was helping save the lives of soldiers in the field. I think it illustrates Elizabeth Holmes's chutzpah and her ability to lie in a way so blatantly and so that, you know, no one thinks to question the assertions because, you know, how could she be lying about things that are so untrue? They must be true.
So what happened to Theranos and to Elizabeth Holmes?
Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes were banned by one of the health regulators, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, from running laboratories and had to shut down their laboratories. They subsequently voided nearly a million blood test results in Arizona and California. Just this past March, the Securities and Exchange Commission announced fraud charges against Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. Elizabeth Holmes chose to settle them without admitting or denying wrongdoing. She paid a $500,000 fine and relinquished most of her stock.
So what about all of those grand old men who were duped by this? George Shultz, who kept throwing birthday parties for Elizabeth Holmes, and all the other people, Jim Mattis, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, Rupert Murdoch. Did any of them admit to being wrong and learning from this magical thinking in which they had all indulged?
You know, very few of them, if any, have, at least publicly. I'm told, however, by a very, very, very good source that George Shultz recently admitted to his family that he had been wrong all along. He did so after reading the SEC charges, and he told members of his family that he had no idea that there had been that amount of lying, and he was clueless about it.
Shultz always claimed he never knew about Iran-Contra when he was Reagan's Secretary of State either.
Right. And he survived Watergate, and his reputation was pretty much unblemished. And unfortunately, he now has to account for his role in the Theranos scandal.
Just an innocent dupe once again. John, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
John Carreyrou is an investigative journalist at The Wall Street Journal and author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup.